Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of real entrepreneurs. And I got to tell you something. If you listen to me, you probably already know I'm a New Yorker. I literally have never been in a pickup truck my whole life. I remember just loving that I could get around in cabs. I finally moved to San Francisco and I felt like I had to have a car. I bought a Prius. It's still, though, no excuse for me to not know about the company that today's guest started. His name is Scott Bintz. He is the founder of Real Truck. It's an e-commerce pickup truck accessory company that he sold to Truck Hero. And the reason I say it's no excuse is successful company in an area of the world that, you know, in e-commerce, selling hard, big, physical things, we didn't know about it. How did I not know about it? Someone who studies this stuff. Partially because his story is not constantly making the top of TechCrunch. He's not on the cover of Fortune magazine. And I'm fascinated by companies like that and entrepreneurs like that. And there are two things that I want to find out about in this interview. Number one, how did he come up with his idea by starting with technology, not necessarily with people? Usually in my interviews, I find that people will find a pain point, a thing that they empathize with their customers, and then they find technology to solve it. He kind of saw that technology was changing the world, and it was internet. And he said, let's see if I could apply this to the real world. And I want to understand the way that he used technology to understand what his customers were going through and empathize with them and then build a business that grew. And the second thing that I want to probe with him is culture. We talk a lot about culture. A lot of people start these lists of things that they stand for. Frankly, we do. And then I'll talk about myself. I have this list of stuff. We put it together 5 years ago, 4 years ago in a Google Doc. I even put an emoji at the beginning of the Google Doc so that it rises up to our Google folder. Nobody looks at it. Nobody follows it. Nobody does it. Scott had a similar situation. It didn't work out. And then when it did, when he made a few changes and it did work out, his company took off and we'll find out what happened. All right, I invited him here to talk about all that, those things. And this interview is sponsored by two companies you've heard me talk about endlessly because they get great results, so they keep sponsoring. The first is called HostGator for hosting your website. The second is called TopTal for hiring a developer. Scott, good to see you.
Good to see you, Andrew.
Hey, you didn't tell our producer what you sold the company for or what your revenues were. I want to hit you with that hard question right away, the one that you didn't tell our producer. What is it? Can you give me a sense of how big you got this business?
Well, you know, we started in a basement and it grew kind of each year it grew. We had one tough year where we had to, when the gas prices went through the roof in 2007 and 8, where we had to tighten the belt. But it grew to over 100 million in sales, and probably not going to discuss what I sold it for. But ultimately, I sold in 2015. I still have a tick of equity in Truck Hero, not much to have an opinion. But and then worked there for a while longer, initially taking the company and handing it off to the next leader. And then I went to the corporate world briefly to help rebuild the Truck Hero factory website and set up a digital marketing web team for them. And then I've been gone doing other things. So,
and now you're an author. The book is called Principles to Fortune, Crafting a Culture to Massively Grow a Business. You know what I wonder about you? Everything about you, so laid back, so comfortable with everything that I did before. I wonder why you would put the effort into putting a book like this together. You don't need to be a guru. You generated good sales. You're not looking to build a cult following. Why do you need to write this book? Why do you need everyone out there to understand the value of culture?
Well, I think, you know, initially when I, at Real Truck, we kind of stumbled along and we were growing, and it was exciting to be an e-commerce company and doing cool things and, you know, breaking records. And then there came a point where it wasn't fulfilling. And so kind of got to looking around at other companies and kind of first we started out as a pickup company that accessory company that sold accessories online. Then we evolved into an e-commerce company that happened to sell truck accessories. Then over time, we kind of evolved to a company on a mission to make people's lives better. and hey, you know, if you want to get your truck accessories from us, you can do that. That's really cool. So I think it was kind of a evolution. So
so what you're saying to me is, look, this thing changed your life, understanding culture, made this business feel less like a business and a thing that you go to every day just because you started it, and more of a mission that you're passionate about. And now you want to spread that gospel to us. And I'm here. I want to listen to it. Let's build up to how you got to that. Because again, this is an issue that I've been struggling with myself. You're a guy who I didn't understand why you had a job, because you're so entrepreneurial. And then I realized it. Let's talk about your entrepreneurial background first. As a kid, you had a bunch of little businesses. Can you tell the audience a little bit about what they were?
Well, yeah, I did about anything from selling greeting cards door to door, had a lawn mowing business. There's kind of a lot of them along the way. So I don't
at remember. At 9 years old, though, you were knocking door to door to sell greeting cards. Why?
Right. I grew up in a trailer park, so we didn't have much money. I'm a single mom, worked as a waitress. And so if I wanted a candy bar or a better baseball glove, usually had to round up the money.
It was because you needed it. If there was anything special you wanted, you had to do it. It wasn't like me that I did it for a passion. You did it because you had to. Did you then find the passion in it? Did you enjoy going door to door? Did you enjoy, what did you like about it?
I think it was the challenge. You know, oftentimes when you're going to do something, I think the world is set up to tell you all the reasons why it won't work out. Not that they're against you, but if you say, hey, I'm going to write this book, it's hard to get published. Is this, is that, da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, oh, cool. I'm glad you're doing it, but they've just given you 100 reasons why you shouldn't. And I think just kind of overcoming that challenge has always been exciting, you know, like, don't tell me I can't do something kind of.
That would fire you up. Instinctively, that's who you were.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit, you know, I think having, being skinny, red hair, I think you're always kind of looked at as the underdog, you know, wasn't picked first for the basketball team or baseball team. And I think trying to find my spot. And it seemed like that was kind of an easier direction to go, you know, when I.
Is it too personal to ask you if you were dating earlier or if this was an issue?
What's that?
Is it too personal to ask you whether you were dating as a teenager or if that was an issue too?
No, I dated on and off, you know, kind of had a somewhat of a long-term relationship in high school. And then, of course, that fizzled out like most do post-high school. So,
okay, so that wasn't, for me, that was a big insecurity. I couldn't do it. And so I said, I better really succeed at business or something, because otherwise I'm going to be nobody. No one's going to like me. All right, so that wasn't it for you. And then you ended up getting a job, including after you graduated from university in North Dakota, you worked for Cellular One, is that right, as a sales rep?
Yeah, the graduated from Minot State University and then got a job as during the cellular boom and selling phones before they even had towers. We had goals. But anyway, so did that
this
for a while.
Back in the early 90s.
Right, early 90s.
Before they had towers. In the 90s, didn't they have those flip phones?
Well, oh yeah, they did bag phones and the Motorola flip. And but when they were kind of setting up the towers, you'd go into the market beforehand and pre-sell. So you'd be selling people phones before they even had the tower.
Like, trust us, this will work soon.
Right.
Got it, really?
You know, $100 a month, you can get 30 minutes. And
how would you convince somebody to buy a phone that didn't work right away?
I think you're an early adopter, that it was coming, you know. They used to say the difference between a cellular salesperson and a used car salesman was that the used car person knows they're lying. With us, we're always pointing out a cover. Yeah, I think you got coverage here at this lake, you know, in the middle of nowhere. Says it on the map. It's kind of red there.
I imagine also back then, if somebody even had a phone in their car, even if they didn't use it, it was kind of impressive for the person sitting in their car for a business meeting or sales meeting or something to just see it. This is a guy who's going places. He's too busy to get out of the car to call. Okay. So you were doing that. And then you saw that this whole cell thing was picking up. And again, as an entrepreneur, inveterate entrepreneur, I think that's the word, you went out and started a little side business. What was the side business?
It was selling accessories. So Western Wireless, which was the company that owned Cellular One, the parent company, which also ultimately fed back to AT&T, but they didn't really have any accessories. You had the Motorola flip phone and the brick phone and the bag phone, and they didn't really have car antennas. They didn't really have too many car chargers and all of the, you know, the billion-dollar industry that's developed now with cell phones. And so I started a company on the side called Cellular World and found places to order all these cellular gadgets. And so I would sell someone a phone, and then I'd put on a different hat and sell them the accessories, which they needed usually. And so I did that. And,
so look at this. You're super entrepreneurial, but because of where you grew up, and it seems like because of the options that you were exposed to, you didn't know that you can go and be an entrepreneur. Am I right? Or did you feel something else?
Yeah, no, I didn't really look at it. You know, I didn't look at myself as an entrepreneur probably for maybe even a year after I sold RealTruck, because I never looked at it. Yeah. I never looked at myself in that light, if that makes sense. I just was a guy trying to do the right thing. And I knew I was a risk taker, and I knew that, I tended to take a higher level of risks than the average bear. And I was, I wanted my life to be useful. I mean, part of the beyond just, I think when I was younger, there's an aspect that I wanted to get rich. And I knew that obviously if you're going to work 40 hours a week, better to get paid $20 an hour than 10. I wanted to kind of have a little more legacy than just, hey, through dumb luck, I started an internet company. I got rich. Aren't you guys all happy? I kind of wanted to have more impact on people's lives.
Okay.
RealTruck was on a mission to make people's lives better. Now I'm kind of on a mission to make business better, if that makes sense, which is why I wrote the book.
All right. Let me get into what you were doing next. So you got the idea for doing this because you are working with resellers, right?
Well, ultimately, yes. So I was, I got demoted at the cellular job. So I was looking for another job, found one for a little company that made a pickup cover, and we were selling those. And the protocol then was you'd call on dealers and work trade shows, and you'd roll this pickup cover back and forth. And I thought, there's got to be an easier way to do this than do 100 trade shows a year. And so in that process, I was working for this factory, and I kind of wanted to make more money, knew they probably weren't in a position to pay me more money. So I said, hey, let me set up a company, independent firm where I represent 10 or 15 pickup accessory manufacturers. You pay me a commission, I'll set up dealers for you. So I kind of evolved to that. But this pickup cover was always kind of my favorite product because I got my start there. When I got my job there, I wheeled in with my Honda Accord. It was the only Honda Accord in the parking lot. And so I was calling on brick and mortar truck accessory stores and selling them truck accessories from various manufacturers. And this pickup cover talked three of them into doing a TV app, hence to forego the trade shows.
Let me see if I'm following you. You're selling this one thing and you say, hey, why am I just selling this one thing? The people who want to buy this cover will want to buy other accessories for their pickup trucks. I'm going to sell multiple things. And then I can make money commission from multiple products. And then you went back to the people who made it and you said, look, if you're getting me to sell it, these trade shows aren't the way to do it. Let's record a commercial. And so you're working with them to record a commercial. Okay.
And then I was calling on pickup accessory stores. So hence one call representing 15 manufacturers, so to speak. But you tended to work your way out of a job in that, being a manufacturer's rep. But anyway, we shot this TV commercial, which again, that was kind of like, that's what big companies do, put it on TV. And we sold some pickup covers. And then about that time, I bought my first office supplies from staples.com. They come to the duplex I was living in. And I thought, this is really cool. And then I thought, I had a buddy going to school for web development. And I thought, what if we took this video that we just put on TV, put it on a website, could we sell the pickup cover? And that's kind of how that Real Truck began, was on that concept. And of course, the feedback at the time was, no one's going to spend that kind of money. They're not going to buy it. They can't see it, touch it, feel it. And so we kind of went to work building this. I went to the factory and said, do you want to do this? They said, no. I said, do you mind if I
build a website for you? Or do you guys want to build a website and start selling directly? They said, no.
No, it'll hurt our dealers. So I said, okay. Well, then I went to these brick and mortar stores I was calling on all over the Northwest, and they weren't interested in it. They were kind of interested. They're in the right now business. And so I set up this website with my friend helped me, my web developer friend. He's going to college. He needed a little cash. And so I paid him. He set up the website, put the video on there and the product. And the first day we launched, we sold a pickup cover to a gentleman in Tennessee, and almost didn't launch because I had to sign a 3-year lease agreement for a credit card company, which took some wrangling because we didn't have a storefront. So it's like, well, how are you going to sell it if you're, you know, in a basement? How are you going to get your customers?
To give people perspective, this is what year?
1998.
Okay. So you had to pay them a monthly fee of, if I remember right, it's like $50 a month.
Yeah, it was $40 a month just for the machine to lease it, which is the ones you see at Mini Mart on the counter with the
push button. Somebody fills in a form on your website, you would take that data. It would go into like a text doc. You would then punch it in manually into the device.
Yep.
And you would send out the order.
Yep.
And by the way, I think you have a screenshot of your original homepage in your book, Principles to Fortune. I'm looking at a screenshot of it right here. You were selling a product that's now made by the company that ended up buying you, Bedrug, right?
No. Well, yes. Truck Hero owns about 15, 16 brands. One of them is Bedrug.
Yeah. And so this is one of the first things that you were selling on your website. And so you got your first sale. We're going to talk about how you got your first sale in a moment. Why don't we, because I think what you did was pretty interesting. Why don't we take a moment here, take a step back, talk about my first sponsor, then get right back into it. My first sponsor is a company called HostGator. Do you know HostGator, Scott?
No, I've heard you talk about them on your shows. Was the first time I became aware of them.
Do you think I do a good job talking about them? Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Yes. Got me to check them out a little bit, so.
I feel like I wish I could take a time machine and go back for you and introduce you to HostGator. Didn't you have issues with hosting companies?
Yeah, there's a few times we were hauling some servers down the highway to the next location as fast as we could.
Oh, really? Because of what?
Well, we had doing the co-host location where we had like the internet go down. I'm not a technical person. I can't write a line of code, and that's not my forte, but where essentially we had no pipes to the internet. So the web guys were, you know, in the middle of the night, moving the servers to another facility that had 3 pipes to the internet. So
I had a terrible issue with a company that I used to use. The site went down. I don't know why. I think it was extra traffic. I couldn't figure out why it went down. I went to their website to find a phone number. There's no phone number. There's nobody. And I'm great at finding people's phone numbers. I could get you on the phone in a moment. I have a couple of techniques that I could tell you in secret afterwards. Get them on the phone. And you have to fill out a support ticket. Do you want to expedite this? They have one of those cute little drop-down menus items where, how are you feeling today? It's just okay. I'm feeling great. Panic, hair on fire. Hair on fire was one of the options of the drop-down. This is very cute, but I need a freaking person. One thing that I like about HostGator is that they do have a person that you can call up 24/7, 365 days a year. Christmas Eve, you can call them. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, Scott. They used to be super quick. Within a minute and a half, they would pick up the call. It's taking a little bit longer, and I don't love that, but it's not impossible to get someone on a call. It takes a little bit of effort, a few extra minutes, but I could get someone on the phone, and I could say, look, I have this problem. help me, human, figure this freaking thing out with me, have some empathy and let's solve it. And because they've been in business for so long and because they've dealt with so many customers, they can solve just about any problem. If you're out there and you need somebody to host your website, right, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. By adding that /Mixergy at the end, you're going to get the lowest prices, as far as I know, lowest prices that they offer anywhere. In fact, if you find someone lower, let me know. But more importantly, guys, extra percent here or there is not the big deal. Big deal is you'll be doing me a favor by going in, so showing them that you support the program by going to hostgator.com/Mixergy and signing up. Scott, that little supporting the program thing doesn't feel authentic to me yet. I've heard other podcasters say it, and I know that sometimes I care about the podcasters I listen to, so I said, let's throw it in at the end. But it feels inauthentic. I don't think people should ever do something for me. They should do it for themselves. And if it happens to benefit me, great. Don't you think?
Yes, but I also think the only people one should try to get even with are the people that you have helped you along the way. So if you can reciprocate, that's a good thing.
You really believe in that? Like the people are going to listen and say, you know what, Andrew's helped me. I'm going to use this URL at the end.
Yeah.
The end of the URL, the slash mixer. Do you do?
I mean, some, yeah.
I think that might be right, but
I mean, if you need hosting and, you know, if you're in that, a position to do that, obviously, website hosting is, not necessarily a, weekly kind of decision. It's a
right
5-year decision.
Right.
Usually. So,
you make a decision once, and then unless they screw you over, you're sticking with the company for 5 years. You know what I'm trying to get at with you is I'm someone who there's not a cynical bent, but a very everyone's out for themselves sense. And that's the way the world works. I told you I grew up in New York. Literally, my sister yesterday hit a car with her bike because the chain fell off her bike. And that was the only way that she could stop with the pedals. Somebody said, oh, are you doing okay? She said, yeah, I think so. Is your phone okay? I said, yeah, I think so. About an hour later, she said, I should go call someone right now because I'm in an ambulance and I need to tell them how I'm doing. She looked in her bag and she realized someone stole my phone. The person who asked about the phone was not checking in on me for the phone. They wanted to know where I was reaching for the phone so they could steal it. That's the attitude I grew up in. You don't have that. I'm trying to guess. Are you a hippie? Are you a trucker? What are you? What box do I put you in, Scott? What's your – how would you describe yourself?
Kind of a underdog, rebel. You know, I think I've always, as a human being, I've always kind of felt like a second class guy, so yeah, to speak. And I think it's been about, you know, being a little bit better me and, you know, working with what you got.
What does it mean for you to feel like a second class guy? I told you, for me, it was no girl was interested in me. I couldn't talk to anyone. I was in my own little bubble that I must have made myself, reading books about what I could do in the future. What was it like for you?
Well, I think, you know, growing up, it always seemed like people were more put together, organized, you know, all of the things that, as you know, when we're younger, our deficits are way greater and our assets.
Yeah, so what was your deficit? Get personal with me. Don't hold back.
I think I was kind of awkward, you know, socially awkward. And so I think probably that's the greatest one of, you know, like, I didn't know until I was in college where a buddy said, well, you say hi, how's it going to the guys and hi to the girls? That made walking down the hallway easier.
And, oh, like you even needed to know how to speak and say hi to people as you're walking down the right, got it.
So.
And that ate you up inside?
What's that?
Not knowing like how to say hi, needing somebody to tell you how to say hi to girls and guys. Did that eat you up inside that you didn't know how to do that?
No, I think I learned. I was kind of younger when I think I learned the ideal of that wise people ask questions and appear foolish for a moment. Fools don't ask questions.
And so okay. You learned that this is the way you have to be.
You know, I kind of always been a question asker. If I don't understand something or want to learn something, I'm not too hindered to not ask a question of something. And I think you speed up the learning curve. In this environment of what we're doing here, obviously you're asking me some questions and some people, it might speed up the learning curve versus trying to figure it all out yourself.
So when you were trying to figure out how to sell online, who could you have even asked back then?
I think it was more with that kind of deal. I think it was just going off of gut instinct on what was going to work and that kind of thing. And then as we got more established, I was able to meet people and hire people that were more experts in their area. You know, one of the hires was a good friend of mine that I'd went to college with, Jeff Lane, Dan Lanningham. And he's the one that said, "Hey, Scott, you got to stop looking at yourself as a pickup accessory store that sells online and look at yourself as an e-commerce company that happens to sell truck accessories and follow e-commerce companies. Don't follow your industry. They don't know what they're doing. Follow e-commerce companies."
Learn more from Amazon than the accessory guy who happens to have a website. Yeah. Right, but the first sales, here's what I have from my research. You submitted yourself to directories, sites like Yahoo, and they were the number one directory. You could just go submit yourself and they'd list you for free. And some of the smaller ones that have disappeared, how did you know that was going to lead to sales? Or was that just an obvious thing back then?
Well, I don't know if it was totally obvious, but it was like, okay, how do you get listed? And so I'd search automotive directory, you know, North Dakota, Washington, and go to all these directories where, you know, you had like, oh, you just had tons of directories at that time. And so I would spend my nights going to these directories and filling out the forms of, you know, company name and, you know, real truck. And then at that time it was real truck, car, pickup, truck, van, and SUV accessories, you know, where the title was about a page long, and fill out all these forms and just kind of kept doing it. And then as the search engines kind of started rising to the top, I think all of those links kind of helped us rank better. And so I don't think the work was fruitful, but it was one of those things of like, I think it's little action after little action is how you kind of climb the mountain, so to speak, rather than swinging for the fence. Oftentimes, I think when I coach people or something, oftentimes what happens is people will try something, it will not get the result they want, and so they'll just quit doing it, rather than sometimes you repackage and present again. Other times you just learn from the lesson and apply that moving forward. And, you know, keep at it, keep stepping up to the plate, so to speak, and swinging, because rarely do you hit it out of the park the first go round.
Yeah, you know what? That's another thing that I noticed about your background, that you were fine selling a few. I would have been so anxious, thought I was a failure if I were just selling one a week. You were doing about that for a while, and then it was an order every 3 days or so, and then it became an order daily, and you just were okay with it because you weren't benchmarking yourself against Jeff Bezos. You were benchmarking yourself against, I imagine, more the people you knew, who you surrounded yourself with when you were building the business, who you grew up with. Am I right?
I think I was just amazed that people would buy something online that they'd never seen from a company that they'd never heard of. And at that time, I was still on a mission trying to convince these brick and mortar pickup accessory stores that they needed to do this themselves. And I'd even clone the website for free for them to do it.
Why? And why did you want them to do it themselves?
I just, at that time, again, I think it probably goes back to, feeling like a second class person, so to speak, or that, because they had the resources, they had the experience, they had the vendors, they had everything you needed to be successful, because they were already selling pickup accessories.
What's in it for you? Did you want to sell them the website? Did you want to be the guy who built it for them?
I think at that point, I was supplying some of the lines. I still had my manufacturer's rep firm, so I was getting a little bit of a commission.
You wanted them to build their website so they would sell your product for you, and you would make a commission, and you thought that's where you fit in the food chain.
Right. And I remember early on that I remember thinking, if I can get 20 of these pickup accessory stores to really get it rocking and get the access roll-up cover and some of these products that I represented on their websites, that when someone searched pickup cover, it would be all of my accounts that would rank number one. And none of them really had the passion for it. I mean, if they did, they would take whoever had the least amount of authority in the at the workplace, and they'd be in charge of the internet. And anyone could overrule them, and everything was more important than the internet, or, you know, online. And so most of them were obviously weren't very successful. But so I'd use RealTruck as a kind of a test case and say, hey, this works and this works. But at that time, they weren't really hearing. And then it just started growing where I sold my rep firm. And then it just.
So this was you actually had a rep firm where you were representing all these products. You sold it for how much? Now that's back ancient history. We can say how much you sold that for, right?
Yeah. At that time, I sold that company for $100,000. And I did it where he bought me out over 3 years because it needed to be, it was a salesperson that worked for me, and it needed to be where he could afford to keep running the business and buy me out. And then I took that money, and that was money kept going, is what helped feed and grow RealTruck, because all of, if we did have any profit, it all went into web development, essentially making the web development better.
And so you sold that first year you make, do you remember how much?
No.
You got about $150,000.
Yeah, sales. Something like that. And then,
so RealTruck is doing $150,000. Your rep business, you sold for $100,000, and you still don't feel like an entrepreneur. You still don't feel like this is who you are.
Never even crossed my mind. I was just like living and trying to build. I mean, I think I always wanted to build something and be a part of something bigger than myself.
Okay.
And you know, obviously I didn't want to, there's a part of me that didn't really want to worry about money, but I never looked at like money as like the destination. It's something you needed to do whatever it is you want to do.
And so what did you do with your life? How did, were you the type of person who was an alcoholic, a workaholic who was working nonstop or something else?
Yeah, a bit. Always kind of been a worker, and, more if I, when I experience flow, so to speak, or that kind of experience, it's always around the work arena. And I'm kind of always thinking about, I've just always had a lot of ideas. You know, I get, it seems like 100 ideas a month and might take action on one of them, if that makes sense.
So you're just constantly thinking, what's the next thing, toying right. around online. How do you decide out of the 100 things, which is the one you're going to focus on and have the discipline not to do 100 things?
I think I just kind of keep running it through my mind and then look at what, is it scalable? Is it you know, going to be helpful? Is it solving a problem that needs to be solved? I think even at the early RealTruck days, RealTruck was solving a problem that needed to be solved, where you kind of had the manufacturer's mentality. Hey, we got 1,000 dealers that can nobody's going to drive 150 miles to buy some Nerf bars for a pickup. I'm sorry, they're just not doing it, you know. And as we were evolving into this anytime you want it, however you want it, kind of market, it was just kind of the next step in that.
The Nerf bars, those are the things that you stand on to get into the truck?
Right.
So like runners or something, running boards, yeah, what are they called?
Well, in the search engine arena, they're called running boards, Nerf bars, step bars. Let me see if I can remember them all. But anyway.
And so this is the way that you got your first customers, SEO, search engine optimization, before it was a thing.
Right.
Cram yourself into as many directories as possible, because people who are into trucks in Chicago would have the website that they would go to on a regular basis, and it happened to have a directory on it that would bring them back. And also that was where you would get to promote yourself. And so that's how you got to $150,000 the first year, second year, $300,000. And the pain, as you expressed it a moment ago, that your customer's experience was they would want something like the Nerf bar, but they would have to drive, what, over an hour out to go get it?
Right, unless they lived in, you know, depending on if that particular brand had a dealer in their market or whatever. But literally, the at that time, the manufacturer's philosophy was, well, if you called from Austin, Texas, and they had a dealer, you know, within 100 miles, that's who they'd send you to, which the reality of it is you're probably not going to go that far. Whereas the internet kind of filled a need for people who wanted those kind of products and to, you know, get them right to your door. I think, and of course you learned along the way that not all people, you know, there's layers of how people look at the world. And, there's also the, you know, who, no one's going to install these products themselves and all of those kind of objections. But I think that's why we tried to make things easier, over time, you know, doing install videos and all that kind of stuff. But I think it was mainly just keeping at it, rather than, listening to the dominant opinion, because the dominant opinion was wrong. It was just absolutely wrong.
Well, and I could see that that is something that fires you up, to see that they're telling you wrong, but you know that you're in the right. Search engine optimization only gets you so far. By year five, you had 5 employees at the business. What's the next step? How do you get customers beyond putting yourself in the early directories?
Well, we started, I think word of mouth, we did come out with a printed catalog. So we looked like we were bigger than we were. And so we had a printed catalog like J.C. Whitney or some of the traditional mail order companies, which, by the way, even the traditional mail order companies didn't, in our sector, didn't do the best job of evolving the e-commerce, which was good because it gave us lots of time to get our shit together. And so to speak, excuse my language.
Keep going.
But I think word of mouth. And then that's when we started just testing a little bit of advertising. And we tried to, I always knew it was cheaper to keep a customer than to find a new one. And I kind of knew if you're a pickup owner, you're probably going to get a new to me truck every 3 years or so. And, or a new truck or a new to me truck. And that, if we did a nice job of taking care of people, that they'd come back for years to come. And that,
can you give me an example of something that you did that shows that you went a little bit more than most people would expect to take care of customers?
Well, we always answered the phone, meaning we didn't have, part of it was we always wanted to, this is even before we got really rocking on culture, but we just wanted, nobody likes calling and hitting 18,000 buttons to get a hold of someone. And so it's like, let's answer a phone. Now we might put you on hold after we answer the phone and try to connect you to the right person as fast as possible, but we're going to answer the phone. And
I saw you had a phone number on your website back when people were afraid to put phone numbers on their sites, because who knows what nefarious use your phone could be used for.
Right.
Yeah. And an email address on the site, clearly. And of course, you always had forms. So phone number on the site. What else did you do to show your customers that they were getting a good experience from you? You sent them a hat. That was a big thing, right? If they bought enough, you'd send them a trucker hat.
Send them a hat and fuzzy dice. And we tended to do, rather than say, hey, buy this stuff and get this, when they did buy whatever, then we would surprise them with something. So if you bought some Nerf bars, you might get an email saying, hey, Andrew, we'd like to send you some fuzzy dice so you can look cool. Do you like red, white, or black fuzzy dice? We tended to do those kind of things, create a memorable experience for our current customers rather than spend a lot of time. Obviously we needed to bring in new customers, but we like really tried to focus on keeping our current ones happy.
You know what else I noticed as I was doing some research on you? You were also really good about being on all these services that now they don't really matter anymore, but like BizRate. BizRate for a long time wanted to be the website that would give people confidence to shop online on sites that they didn't know of, because everyone would get to go and rate the businesses that they bought from. And so you were in that directory and you were kind of minding that and you were doing stuff like that. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're on, at that time, I think there's 2 or 3 or 4 of them. And so, we're working that all the time. And, it was, for a couple of years there, we hit their, circle of, excellence, level which not too many people ever reach. So that was kind of cool.
Because this was you obsessing about your business, going in and saying, what's the new thing that's out there that I could be excited about? This is where your 100 ideas would come from. Constantly exploring, playing around, saying, we should be on this, we should do this, we should do this other thing. And then you ended up you ended up picking one of those ideas. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book, Andrew, was here's my experience. I'm going to take one step back. I get a lot of juice for Real Truck, but the reality of it is I had a lot of really, really good people around me that helped do it. And I was kind of like certainly the heartbeat a little bit and the big, big pusher of things. But Real Truck would not have been successful without the people that were around, right people in the truck, in the right seat, so to speak. But oftentimes people read the book Good to Great and they'll get all fired up about it.
You're talking about the phrase in Good to Great, get the right people on the bus, meaning have the right employees at a company, and that's what allows you to go far. You're turning it into the right people on the truck, and you're saying other people would read the same book as you did, hear the idea of get the right people, and they would do what?
Well, they read the book and they take it back to their company and they get excited about the book and they try to take some of these things back to whatever they're doing and they tend to hit roadblocks. And we hit roadblocks too. I read the book, loved it. And where it talked about what great companies do that good don't. And there's a lot of things we adopted from that. Where let's be good, let's be better than anyone in our space in a few areas. Do that so well, they won't notice what we don't do. And so we really wanted to knock it out of the park with customer care, and we wanted to create memorable experiences. And but oftentimes, and so you want to develop this better business. Well, how do you do it? And of course, we'd come up with some core values, put them on the wall. A year later, nobody embraced them. I was kind of like dumbfound. But how do you get it into your culture? Because every group of people has a culture, whether you realize it or not. It's either
Let me take a break and talk about my sponsor, and then we'll dive into this culture. What did you do wrong then with people, and how did you get it right? My sponsor, I'm going to do a quick ad for them. It's a company called TopTal. I needed to hire somebody to do user experience design work for me. And what I wanted was not someone who was just going to come in, do it their way, and then disappear, but someone who would actually understand what we were, how we worked. We do it. We're kind of quirky as a company. We get on calls occasionally on the phone. We need to use Basecamp because we like how quiet Basecamp keeps working. We need a lot of interaction when it comes to things that we're not comfortable with, like user experience. I didn't want to just hire an agency. I couldn't hire somebody full time because I don't have that much work for them. And so I went to TopTal. I said, "Do you guys have a user experience person?" I said, "Of course we do. That's what you've been talking about in your ads." I said, "Great, I need it." They brought two people to me. I think it was two. The first person we talked to was perfect. We hired him. He understood how our business worked because he worked like he was in our business. He understood the problems that our users had because he dove in and understood it. And then he gave us a user experience design that we built our whole search on. If you're out there and you're looking to hire somebody to do user experience, in addition to developers, in addition to finance people, you should know that TopTal has phenomenal user experience people. Here's what I want you to do. Go to this special URL. Well, really, I know you're never going to find a better deal than this from TopTal. They're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. If at the end of the period you're not 100% satisfied, you will not be billed. Go to toptal.com/mixerg. That's top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent, toptal.com/mixerg. Really, you guys are going to love them. All right. You know what? Let me take a second here before we get into, I want to talk about this one transformative moment in your life that led you to go on this path. Someone saw you at 2003. You had 5 employees, 5 years into your business. You were doing well. He flies in. And he says what? What did he fly in and what did he say to you that I think helped change the way that you were looking at your business?
Well, at that time, a company flew in and offered on jets.
On a jet, like a private jet. They flew into
a private jet. And I didn't know anyone in private jets at that time. So that was pretty cool. And that they were coming to see us. And I wanted to buy a Real Truck for $1 million. And at that time, I just thought, we're not done. there's more for us to do. And I didn't think that, I just wasn't interested in the offer. I was flattered by it, but I thought there's more for us to do.
I feel like that kind of kicked your ass too. You also realized you need to get aggressive. You told our producer at that point, I needed to be more aggressive or die. Why did you feel like you had to be more aggressive in order to survive?
Well, I thought, you know, at that time, there's probably 200 or 300 companies selling pickup truck accessories online. And I thought, we either go deep or die the other. You cannot be stagnant. And it's going to be, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, it's going to be 2 or 3 or 4 players that dominate. And so we either need to grow or go. And so it was kind of at that time, all in, and let's get this thing rocking. Let's do it better than we ever have.
All right. So then you told the producer too, I bet everything on company culture. Why bet on company culture? Why not bet everything on great marketing? Why not bet everything on, I don't know. Why company culture of all things?
I think some of it was probably a legacy thing. I didn't want my legacy to be through dumb luck. I started an internet company and got rich. I wanted to kind of have more impact, be useful to people. And my buddy Jeff, also who was the president of Real Truck, gave me or told me about Zappos. And I thought, how cool. Here's this guy, sells Tony Hsieh, $1 billion worth of shoes. He's not the cheapest, and they have a really fun work culture. Of course, then you get the disconnect. He's an Ivy Leaguer, got a bunch of money to start with, you know, sold a company for $240 million, blah, blah, you know, where like, okay. And then I had this, like, you know, with inspiration, people think like, sometimes people meet me and they're disappointed because I think they're expecting this, someone more dynamic 100% of the time, but inspiration is a limited bandwidth thing. You got to act on it when you got it. In hindsight, that's what I would say. When you get inspired, go with it, because you're not going to stay inspired your whole life. You might not even stay inspired longer than a week.
So if you're inspired, capitalize. But rock and roll. Tony Hsieh at the time was not yet, we're talking about 2003, 2004, 2005. He did not become famous for culture until 2008 or so. And so here you are, even later. Well, you weren't guided by him. You were guided by an understanding that your company needed this somehow.
Well, yes, we were trying to like, hey, can we run the company by principles? We didn't know how. And because we were following e-commerce companies that were doing well, that's how we became familiar with Zappos.
So this was before even Zappos made it big with this whole culture. You said, I want to guide the company by something. It should be a set of principles that then I could take and hand over to the next generation who runs my company. This is how we're going to live. It was like programming a company for you. Am I right?
Well, yeah, a little bit like that. And
just I was learning it out.
Yeah, I was reading articles on Zappos and that kind of thing. We flew down there and found out they had tours. We were just going to like scope and but
you were just going to scope them out for what?
Just see how they're running their business. We're just like, what are they doing that they're kind of building this really fun employee culture? And then our first attempt at culture in an organized sense was more in that 2007, 2008 range. And then, but ultimately started, that's when I learned about, you know, good to great, tribal leadership, Chip Conley's How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And we're looking on, but the problem with all of that, those books, they really good info. I love those books. Those were, and eventually Tony Hsieh's book, Delivering Happiness, were the core books for the truck. But none of them really tell you, like, how do you actually do this? How do you get it into your culture? How do you get your culture rocking? So we put these principles on the wall. Nobody embraced them. A year later, we kind of reinvented ourselves. And I said, let's find out. I knew everybody that worked for me had their own principles that they lived by, but sometimes struggled with bringing them to work. And I particularly had people I went to college with and met throughout the years that worked for like Fortune 500 companies that had great principles in their personal life, but lots of conflict with them at work for job preservation, et cetera, et cetera. And I just thought, you know, how terrible that, you know, I had a buddy that was in pharma that you couldn't wine and dine doctors, so they'd make it look like he was seeing 20 doctors a week and maybe one a month. And the whole industry was doing this.
They all pretended they were seeing more patients than they really were so they could get the money that they felt they deserved for the few patients that they were really seeing.
Well, the pharma rep, so they could get, so they could keep their job and then try to educate doctors on their medications they were selling.
But the pharma reps were saying they were seeing more doctors than they actually saw, so they could get more money for it. Right. You said, this is not the kind of company that I would want. I have to breed the right culture to avoid this type of thing. Am I right?
Right, right. And how can we free people? So I asked everybody what their guiding principles were, what they live by, what are their mottos, the principles, the values that they live by or want to live. Got all of these back, and I'm kind of a pattern person. It's hard to explain, but so I got all of these back and I started putting them in buckets, and it was, the first one was deliver more, and get things like, I want to create great experiences. I want to have fun. I want to leave it better than I found it. I, you know, all of these different versions of values. And so essentially I compiled those into, or we compiled those into six: deliver more, transparency rocks, improve, take risks, include fun, and be humble. And that we introduce those to the company one at a time. We'd focus on one, deliver more. So we'd say, how can we deliver more to our customers? Where aren't we delivering more? Where are we not? What can I personally do to deliver more to our customers, partners, or employees, you know, each sector? And we started asking a lot of questions, getting lists, sharing those lists, and with everybody in the company. And that's kind of how we got those into the culture kind of on a daily basis.
And so then, I keep summing this up because, Scott, usually if I'm just listening, I could let you go. But if I'm trying to really use this, I want to make sure that I fully understand it. Here's what I'm understanding you saying. At first, it was you saying, I got to program this company. I'm going to put together a list of what we stand for, our principles, and I'll put it up and everyone will follow it. Nobody saw it. Nobody followed it because it was yours and because you didn't make sure to live it. Then you came back and said, all right, let me take a step back and see, what does everyone else believe in? I'll put a list of the things. And this is what Tony Hsieh said he did in his book, To Delivering Happiness. I'll put that list together and then I will work with the team to make sure that they all use it and get rewarded for using what's on the list. Am I right?
Right.
Well, let me ask you this though. The problem with asking everyone else, what do you stand for, is you don't get the company that you, Scott, envision. Like, you really envision a certain thing. You created this back when nobody believed in e-commerce. And so you have a vision. Don't you want to carry that through in the company principles and say, here's the next step of the vision, like you did before?
Well, my vision really evolved to, I wanted a Real Truck to be an icon for how companies should treat customers, partners, and employees. And I kind of seen that if we could get on the same sheet of music that believe in the same kind of things, that it would be easier to accomplish. So there was a strategy in it.
So it's still your vision, but now, guys, within this vision, what do you think we could do? So having them give input into it made it feel more like it was theirs.
Right. And they were guiding principles to help people guide decisions, because it couldn't be off of, people couldn't make decisions to keep growing the company based on what they think Scott would do in this situation. That's not scalable in any capacity.
It's not trying to, because many people won't know you as the business grows the way that they did when you were just five people. Got it. So was that part of the impetus, saying, I can't keep guiding people every day by telling them what to do? They can't see me and say, I see how Scott would do it, I'll do it too. We need these principles. You start writing the principles and then it doesn't work. And then you say, let's write it together.
Right. And there's a, yes, c- kind of. There's a whiny side to that too. I had this little whine, like, why can't anything ever get done without me? So to speak. Right? So it was there was some truth to that, but I was also the creator of that to some extent because I hadn't empowered people. Well, now they could use those same principles to put me in my place or question what I'm doing or not doing. And it was okay. Like, is this delivering more? Is it transparent? You know, does it fall under and poop? Is it including fun? Is it, you know, and with some of that, the result of it was amazing. I mean, we had ads running on our front page of our website that would say, we sell bacon and truck accessories and we're all out of bacon. And you had, when partners would come visit us in North Dakota, they'd get rock star welcomes and it would create some of the whole business trips they'd ever taken. Right from us, no Ivy Leaguers, no money, just regular everyday folks from North Dakota doing really cool things. And to conclude, you know, that's why I wrote the book, was like, hey, you can be an average person in business and do some really cool things. You can get principles involved in your business where your employees connect to them.
Did you use the word principles because of the Ray Dalio book? That he says everyone has principles, or the best leaders do. I want the rest of them to do it. Is this part of it?
No. It was Zappo. The first when we first did values, we called them core values. A year later, nobody knew them. We reinvented them as guiding principles at that time to guide us. And kind of that was a marketing aspect of where, since we kind of failed at quote core values, we were kind of rebranding it as, hey, these are guiding principles to guide us. And so that's kind of, and then the title of the book came from Principles of Fortune. Believe it or not, I hadn't heard of Ray's book. And at that time, until after I'd already picked the name, and the fortune really isn't about, you know, getting rich. The fortune is about, the things that come when you live by principles.
Okay. You told me how you got the principles together. You told me that sharing with others made them feel ownership. You were starting to tell me a little bit about how on a weekly basis you live those principles and you made sure that everyone understood that. Can you tell me more? What did you do once you had this list? What did you do to encourage people to actually use it?
Well, we would, all of the teams and stuff would get together and have meetings on and asking questions like, transparency rocks. We're a North Dakota company in a conservative North Dakota company in a Facebook world, right? So with transparency rocks, open and honest communication, like, where are we transparent with our customers? Where are we not transparent?
This is on a weekly basis you would do this? You'd say, today we're going to think about transparency rocks. Where are we? Or this week? Is that how you do it?
Right. Well, we would do it in 2 months where we would kind of focus on one principle for 2 months.
Got it.
Then we would, I would also, we had what we call weekly manager meetings. What at the time we called them 9 at 9 because there's 9 people on it. And anyway, and I would ask each of the leaders to juice someone for practicing in their department for practicing a given principle like transparency rocks, and then juice someone outside of their department for practicing that principle. And then I would do a weekly video that I would share those out that.
So and this is encouraging people to do it so that they're noticed, to notice it so that they see that we're all doing it, to get to know people outside the company, and for you then to have almost like case studies of how we are humble or how we include include fun, et cetera, right?
Right. So people could see examples of it and kind of connect the dots because that's not necessarily – is self-evident of, you know, what is delivering more? Is delivering more opening the door for someone? No, that you should do that. You know, it's maybe what you, so just to have some awareness of what is, you know, is including fun, you know, playing a video game at your desk all day? No, that's, you know, including fun is, you know, where this aspect of, hey, if we're going to work 40 hours a week, let's have a good time doing it. What can we do to include fun with the things we do, whether it's a meeting, whether it's a website, how we design it, our marketing.
So you're explaining it by having them use it. And you told our producer, this is like I told you, I cultivate a very New York attitude in this podcast because that's where I grew up. You told our producer, let's get the dollars and cents of all this, that suddenly you went to $12 million in annual sales in 24, then $60 million. And you attribute how much of that to this set of principles and the understanding that the culture has to reflect them?
All of it. It was, I mean, what happened was is you had an entire company of people on a mission greater than themselves to make people's lives and vehicles better. And the innovation and some of the operational efficiencies that came from that were phenomenal because why are we doing this? And if someone couldn't answer the question, we stopped doing it. And people were empowered to take risks like that. And then the Including Fun created a lot of memorable experiences, customers, our business partners and employees. You know, when we do those rock star welcomes with vendors, what would happen down the road is they'd oftentimes hook us up with the best new product first. So we'd be the first company to launch something online. Or
because you gave them such a fun experience and they connected with who you were.
And we tried to be transparent with them too. And we'd share sales numbers and we'd ask, hey, vendor, what can we do to be a better business partner to you? What are we not doing? What should we be doing? And so those kind of things kind of throughout the whole company. And so, we were at 6 million, 8 and jumped to 12 and 25 and 42 million and 60 million. And even the development was looking at it in the same light. It was amazing to be a part of.
Then should we be doing as part of your belief that you need to keep improving?
What was that, Andrew?
The you kept asking them what could we be doing? Because that's part of your principles. You have to keep improving.
Yeah, I'm kind of a guy who's got a rock in his shoe where I'm always kind of like, how can we do this better? How can we simplify this? How can we make this more efficient? And so I think it's kind of a natural, it's just an area. I'm always kind of like that. So
I'm going to go back to a little bit of like me playing armchair psychologist with you. Because one of the things that I'm curious about is you said, I highlighted this phrase from your conversation with our producer, I have a doubtful passenger, in quotes. What is your doubtful passenger? What does that mean?
It's the thing in your mind and out in the world that tells you why you can't do something. And you have to, like, for me, I've had to learn to tame that. So... and to put context to it, it was when I was writing the book Principles of Fortune, I didn't really know exactly where people asked me to write a book. And I thought, well, I'm not a writer. I can't write a book. And then finally got, well, sure. It can't be that hard. Too many people wrote a book. Right. So I'll try. But I wrote this section. I haven't published it yet. I don't know if I will, but was this oftentimes we have, when I had the idea of Real Truck, everybody told me why it wouldn't work. Nobody's going to buy something. That's an exterior doubtful passenger. And then also the one within our mind where we say, like, when I had this inspiration, I was looking at Zappos and Tony, well, Ivy Leaguer, bunch of money, in San Fran, Vegas, where so a lot of talent around them. And it was like, becomes this list of why we can't do it.
And that's your doubtful passenger going in. And instead of taking in what Tony's saying and saying, I could use it, says, you can't use it. He's in San Francisco. He's got an Ivy League education. He's got more money, et cetera.
And then, but there's this aspect of flipping it of like, well, all those things may be true. However, let's do it anyway, but with my own personality on it, or our own personality. Let's embrace the fact we're from North Dakota. Let's trustworthy, hardworking. Let's do the best with what we have. Let's
say you took all those negatives that your doubtful passenger brought in and you countered them and you challenged them and you ended up realizing that being from North Dakota is actually better than San Francisco in some ways.
Right. So it was like to shift it to why can't we do it? Maybe we won't do it at the same level. Maybe we won't be having dinner with Jeff Bezos anytime soon, but we can do some cool shit right here, right from North Dakota, with no money and a truckload of really good people with a purpose beyond just more. Because when we got into culture, it was seemed like we're in endless pursuit of more. More sales, more products, more this, more that, more. And which is fatiguing when you're doing it without a purpose or usefulness behind it, in my opinion.
And so you wrote a chapter on this doubtful passenger. You didn't include it in the book, but you
right. It didn't really. The public or the editor was like, "This in no way relates to
it." Doesn't
what's
not
the
directly.
Context of the book? And I at that time I was kind of arguing. I said, "Well, you can't do all of this stuff if you don't get rid of the doubtful passenger. You got to tame him." And so, but anyway, the book is about kind of how we, a little bit about me and how Real Truck began, and then how we got the principles in the business, and it ends with a little bit on, e-commerce concepts, and then
would you be willing to do this? If anyone listens to this interview and goes out and gets Principles to Fortune, can they email you a receipt or something or a picture of themselves with the book and then have you send them that chapter that was not in the book?
Yes, I will do that. I'll
you
need about
that.
A month to clean it up because it's got a lot of cuss words in it. But
no, would you keep the cuss words in there and let it be a really like raw thing?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it in the aspect of this aspect of labels that we strap to ourselves. So like when I was younger, I was, how one looks at people or how you look at yourself versus how people are labeling you on the way, and that we box ourselves in by these things sometimes, and how to get rid of the labels or add context to them. Meaning I've been called an asshole and brilliant, right? In the same day, or at the same token, in the same day, I've been told I have a kind heart and that I'm dumb, right? In the same day, which are polar opposites. Well, how do you give context to those things? What are the things that are really me and what are the things that are brief moments? And that's what that chapter is kind of about. Anyway.
But how do you want to do this? Do you want to give your personal email address in here? Do you want me to give you an @Mixergy email? Do you want me to create a form for people to fill out that automatically sends things to you? What's your preference?
Well, they can go to the principlestofortune.com website or scottbentz.com website and fill out the form there to reach me.
So fill out the form on principlestofortune.com. I'm going to go to that right now. I want to make sure that we're sending people to a good spot. I'm curious to see how many people are going to do this. I'm definitely going to send you my receipt. So principlestofortune.com. Somewhere on here is a form. Where is the form?
Should say.
Is it under contact?
Yeah, contact.
Contact us. I'm going to go to contact us. And then it leads me to a form. Okay, so all they have to do is somewhere in here let you know that they bought the book because of Mixergy, and you're going to send them this private thing, and we're counting on them to keep it super private.
Yeah.
Right. Why'd you sell the business? I want to close out with that.
I think at that time, again, that goes back to I like this is really big, and the same skills you need to run $100 million company are not the same ones for 10. And I think I thought I wanted to pass it on into smarter hands so Real Truck could be around for years to come. And I wanted to find someone, I wanted to, obviously there's part of me that wanted to take care of my family. That didn't want to have to worry about money.
You have five kids. You didn't want to leave it to one of the five kids to run?
No, I mean, all of my five kids have worked for me at one time or another. And actually, two of them still work at Real Truck, two of my, older daughters. And, I think, I wanted to put it in good hands ultimately. And I wanted to, it be a company that believed in the culture and that would be able to invest in it, because I always felt like if we could invest in it a little bit more, it could be that much greater of an experience, particularly with how the market was going. I think in retrospect, it would have been one of those things I would have told myself, this too shall pass. I kind of felt like I was tapped out as a leader.
But if you, but maybe you could have continued even further if you took a little bit of space, if you allowed whatever you're feeling to go on, you're saying.
Right. But at the same token, I'm kind of, now I'm in this, you know, second chapter and kind of moving more in the aspect of, you know, what can we, going back to writing the book, was like, if we can make business in general a little bit better, where more businesses focus on the culture, it's kind of a bigger win, and kind of giving back in that circle. You know, when I talk to people and they'll, the feedback I've gotten on the book is kind of somewhat profound, where I'll get people that will say, you know, I read your book, I couldn't put it down, and there's 50 things in that book that I can do to improve my business right now. And when I hear that kind of thing, it kind of, when I hear people get re-inspired, it's kind of rewarding, and particularly to get re-inspired to be, rather than just survival mode or make a bunch of money, but more so to do it with a little bit of calculation and purpose, it means even more. Because I needed that direction, I think.
Could this even be useful for someone who has a company that's the size of yours back when you were 5 years in, like five people company? Could they still start off with these principles?
Yes. I think the, yes, definitely. I think the, in, it becomes a lot easier to do something with five people than 100 or 1,000. And there's also, every company is a little bit different. Obviously, if you're building rockets, you're probably going to want to have some principles about accuracy and precision and perfectionism, maybe even. But the same concepts apply. But whether you're, you know, have some coffee shops you're trying to grow, or whether you're, I think even in corporate America, there's probably a few, you know, there's good corporate America, not so good corporate. There's shitty corporate America and good corporate America, but I think there's even things you can do there to make things a little bit better, where oftentimes the pursuit of profit is also the same thing that wrecks brands.
And you're a person who's built a brand. You are also part of a brand. I see here a UPS ad with you, which is such a cool photo of you in this UPS ad using a truck part as like a guitar. Yeah. So the reason I say this is you're not some hippie college professor who's saying we need culture and we need to de-emphasize profit. You're a guy who produced profit, produced revenue, over $100 million, sold your business, created a brand, created a culture, and now you've written a book for anyone else who wants to follow along and learn the way that you learn from so many other books. The book is called Principles to Fortune. Guys, if you do get that book, go send him a copy of your receipt so you can read the extra chapter that's not in the book. Leave the curse words in, Scott. I think my audience would actually respect even the typos. They feel more connected to you because of that. Really admire what you built up here. I'm so glad that you're on here doing this interview with me.
And yes, thank you. Yeah,
notice
thanks
how
for
you got fired up when we started talking about the principles. In the beginning, before we started, you were sitting and drinking your tea or whatever you were drinking. Then we had a conversation, it was very lighthearted. Once I was going into principles, you were like, you could have jumped through the webcam almost to come at me.
Yeah, I think I get a little bit excited about that, or passionate about it. I think love to talk about it.
I do too. I'm so proud to have you on here, and I'm glad that you're talking about this, and I'm glad I got to talk to you about it. All right, Principles to Fortune. Go and get the book, guys. Let me know too what you think of it. And I want to thank my two sponsors for making this happen. The first, look, if you're building a website, you obviously need a hosting company, one that's going to be around, one that's not going to force you to get your stuff. No one actually, forget. I was going to say one that's not going to force you to put all your hardware into a car and move it from one co-location to another. That doesn't happen anymore. But one that's not going to force you to work forever just to get them to take care of your problem. And that's what HostGator is about. Company's been around forever and will take good care of you. Go to hostgator.com/mixergy. And if you need to hire a developer, like a Silicon Valley level developer, if you're maybe like Scott, you're feeling like, oh, I don't have any Silicon Valley connections. What's wrong with me for living outside of the Valley? Let me tell you something. The best developers are living outside of the Valley too. All you have to do is go to toptal.com/mixergy. They'll hook you up with someone and you got nothing to lose. Just give them a shot. Give them a shot. They won't even charge you anything before they introduce you to someone who's going to blow your mind. toptal.com/mixergy. And if you have a speaker or any other device that is a little bit smart, shout at it. Say, play Mixergy podcast. And you'll be amazed by how fun it is to have your speaker play my voice around your house. Right, Scott?
Yes, definitely.
Do you have an Alexa speaker yet in your house?
What's that?
Do you have a speaker, a smart speaker, like an Alexa or something?
No.
Oh, you know what? I got to get your address. Where do I mail? Do you have a mailing address that's not private? I want to mail you one of these. It's going to change your life. You're going to start shouting at the speaker all day long.
All right. Yeah, I can get you that.
What's here? Put it in the chat. I'm going to say goodbye to everyone here. I'm going to send the chat to you. Hi. It could be an office address. I'm not looking for your home address. I don't want to get to know you in like a way that feels creepy, but I do want to blow your mind with how good a smart speaker can be. Now it's playing Mixergy. You're going to have my voice in your house.
Awesome. Yeah, this has been awesome, Andrew. I've done a lot of interviews over the year. You're really good at this, so it's been fun.
Thanks. I've done a lot of interviews, too. I like how good you are. All right, he's going to type his address. We won't hang up until I get his address. I can send him a smart speaker. Guys, if you have one, play Mixergy, and thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.